Israeli state narratives are rarely challenged. If you have seen one, just send me the link in mainstream news coverage. In the name of so-called objectivity, lies are often given a platform to quote-unquote counterbalance the voices of Palestinians. So this is a grotesque, you know, asymmetry, a false equivalence, because even when, for example, a basic and verifiable Palestinian claim, such as that 2 hours ago my entire family has been wiped out in a matter of hours, this is, you know, treated with suspicion, interrogated for proof, or framed as allegations, allegedly. Meanwhile, official Israeli statements, no matter how implausible or unsubstantiated, are reported uncritically, often repeated verbatim, and granted the authority of fact. This is not objectivity. Journalism does not fulfill its duty by giving equal weight to truth and misinformation and propaganda. This is not what journalists do. To amplify state misinformation and disinformation under the guise of neutrality is not impartial. It does the inverse. So we all also remember how the uncritical circulation of the false beheaded babies by Hamas. It made global headlines, amplified by heads of states, and then it, you know, evaporated. But when it retracted, its purpose had already been fulfilled. It had reinscribed the Israeli exceptionalism and the Palestinian Hamas monstrosity. So I do not believe this is journalistic failure, as, I mean, Said has been cited a lot. As Said said, I think, decades ago, media often functions in perfect synchrony with colonial policy. That synchrony today extends from talking points of heads of states or policymakers and think tankers to editorial priorities to the silencing of Palestinians. One last issue we all need to remember is more infrastructure. It's also about the financing of journalism, which is in shambles right now. For example, even beyond the Orientalist habits and colonial hierarchies of Western newsrooms, we now face a bottleneck controlled by a number of unelected and bizarre tech oligarchs. That platform, social media platforms, as you know, regulate the flow of information. And this is, like you say, where most people now encounter the news. But they are governed by opaque algorithms, surveillance capitalism, and the whims of a few billionaires who allegedly moderate in, perfect political correctness. So, yes, there is systemic racism, complacency, and narrative control in the newsrooms. But even these were magically resolved tomorrow, we would still be confronted with the filters of a few eccentric, profit-driven men, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, and Sundar Pichai, for example. It used to be, we used to have the media censorship, authoritarian reprisal, editorial ownership problem, advertiser problem. Those dynamics remain, but now every journalist and Palestinian witness must also hurdle past these tech barons who decide without any oversight and conscience whose stories circulate and whose are buried. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ezra, for this tour d'horizon, for this holistic analysis, really. And you referred to the manipulative headlines, basically. And just when we are talking about Israeli kids, it is children. You know, but when we are referring to Palestinians, it's always minors. And Palestinians, you know, just are always killed in the passive tense. Who did that? You know, just it's always up in the air. And I believe it's a good segue for me to move on to Asal Rudd. Asal is joining us from Los Angeles. Yes, now we can see her. Asal, it's an ungodly hour in Los Angeles, I believe, and we are so grateful to you for joining us at that time, you know, just in Los Angeles. Asal, you're an academic. You've been working on the U.S. foreign policy, U.S.-Iran relations, Iranian history, and of course on Palestine as well. But I believe over the last 2 years or so, in the very first place, a lot of people got to know you as the so-called headlines fixer. I mean, you started, you know, correcting, you know, just all those manipulative headlines. And that's why I believe, you know, you've accumulated a good deal of experience on those manipulative headlines. And what do you think about the underlying biases of the Western media? Why do you think it happens? How do you read that? Over to you.
I think it's interesting, as I've been listening to everybody speak, obviously, I thought Victoria's point was so interesting about how we have these alternative medias and younger generations are not reliant on sort of mainstream legacy medias in the West, which is true. And we're happy to know that. And that's part of the reason why you've seen, I mean, I'm in the United States. I've grown up in the US. We are, when it comes to the issue of Israel-Palestine, I don't think, I mean, there might be debates about other European countries that do this, but we're quite propagandized in terms of the way the entire narrative has been framed for decades. And so while we're focused on Gaza because we've watched a live stream genocide unfold every day on our phones, on our devices, in a way that we haven't seen before, A, because of the level of atrocity, and B, because of the access that we have to that information, because, and I think we've talked about this, but it's always important to emphasize, because of Palestinian journalists on the ground. It is, I don't know what word to use, maybe remarkable, to think about the fact that Palestinians have to report their own genocide because their Western colleagues refuse to call it that. That is, I think, one of the issues that we'll be studying for years to come, how the Western world, which champions the idea of a free press, and we can talk about what a free press actually is supposed to do, but that champions this idea of a free press as a foundation of their democratic liberal societies, have completely failed in acknowledging the slaughter of their colleagues because they're Palestinian and because the perpetrator of those crimes is Israel. The fact that they have failed to report what is actually happening, and the fact that they've whitewashed Israel's crimes throughout this genocide, as we've seen. And so the narrative shift that you've seen in the U.S., where there's actually now polling where Israel has lost favor, lost quite a bit of favor in the American populace, is because of those very sources, the fact that there is social media, the fact that we're, despite the fact that the mainstream media is not showing you these stories, people are still seeing them. At the same time, I would say that legacy media still has a huge role and influence in the broad narrative, especially because we have aged societies. Like there are people, there are many, many people over 30 who are still looking at these broadcasts, whether they're watching it on television or whether they're, you know, reading a newspaper, reading something on their phones. I think there's another part where social media actually plays a factor, because a lot of individuals in the public are not following these events the way that we necessarily are. And so the way that they're getting information is passive. As you're scrolling through and you see a post or a headline, and this is why I focus so much on headlines, that passive way of receiving information is how thoughts and ideas are being shaped. And this is essentially how propaganda works. If you repeat something over and over and over again, it starts to stick in people's minds and they assume that it's a truth. For instance, if you've ever heard the phrase, Israel has a right to defend itself, because it gets repeated over and over and over again. But you never hear the phrase, Palestinians have a right to defend themselves. Palestine has a right to defend itself. Iraq has a right to defend itself. Iran has a right to defend itself. Lebanon has a right to defend itself. That phrase is never uttered, but Israel has a right to defend itself is repeatedly said until this becomes an ingrained concept within the mind of the public. And so this brings me to the sort of question, again, not repeating the fact that I think we've covered a little bit about how, you know, how dehumanizing language works, how whitewashing works by lack of attribution to Israel, not naming Israel as the culprit, how framing is important. We've discussed all of that. So let's just talk for a moment about what is a free press? What's supposed to be a free press? What's the difference between what we call a free press in the West and an authoritarian under, or the press under an authoritarian state? Well, in an authoritarian system, there's no journalistic freedom theoretically. And that means that journalists or these institutions, media institutions, simply repeat what the state says because there's no space in which they can challenge the state narrative. That's precisely what we've seen occur in terms of how Western media has covered the Gaza genocide. Just the fact that they don't use the word genocide to describe what is happening. The fact that there have been UN reports that concluded that Israel is committing genocide that get basically no coverage in the West. When the largest human rights organizations in the world, such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, come out with reports saying Israel is committing genocide, meaning they've concluded that Israel's actions constitute genocide, it's still framed as allegations. And within the same headline, you get something that says Israel denies this, as if the party committing genocide has an equal say in whether or not they are committing genocide, and not the institutions that were created to prevent said genocide from happening. So, what you've seen in the Western media is a repetition of whatever is the Israeli state says, Israeli officials say, as truth. It's presented as truth. Israel says, is often, you don't even have to see Israel says. You'll see headlines that say, 50 Palestinians killed. Well, I wish they would say 50 Palestinians killed, but, 50 people killed in Israeli airstrike targeting Hamas. It doesn't even say Israel says they were targeting Hamas. It just says targeting Hamas, stated as a fact. When those 50 people who died, most of which were women and children, clearly not targeting Hamas. So, this is the kind of repetition of Israeli positions that you see, as well as US government positions. When it was the Biden administration, whatever the Biden administration said, that was repeated in the news. If President Biden said, questioned the death toll, which he did very early on in the genocide, dehumanizing Palestinians in the process, that's when you see the emergence of this phrase when he says he doesn't trust those numbers. Of Hamas-run health ministry, and the media picks this up and everybody starts using it, all to undermine the numbers, which are actually underestimates. The number of people killed, we do not know, but we just know it's much higher than what we've actually been able to see because the chaos on the ground doesn't really allow for accurate counting and measuring and identifying of bodies. Just imagine how many thousands of people are still buried under rubble. And they cannot be retrieved because Israel destroys the heavy machinery needed to retrieve those bodies. So the idea of the free press is supposed to be to challenge the state and to tell the truth. It's not to point out what both sides are saying. It's to say, what is the truth? And that is what has been lacking in this coverage. And there's one more point that I wanted to make and using a concrete example, because we've talked about this idea that a few of the speakers have mentioned Palestinian journalists and the fact that Western journalists have not, foreign journalists have not been allowed into Gaza. But you have Palestinian journalists on the ground. They're trying to do this work, and they are doing this work. The reason why there's reporting lacking sometimes in the Western world is because they don't listen to Palestinians on the ground. So the horrific story of 15 Palestinian medics slaughtered by Israel. Which Israel lied about after burying them in mass graves, crushing their ambulances and burying those along with the bodies. Palestinians were reporting that this was happening many days, about a week before the story finally started getting played on mainstream media. And that's only because the UN finally revealed a mass grave with aid workers, with 15 aid workers still in there. Still wearing their uniforms in mass graves with crushed ambulances. So it wasn't until the UN actually revealed the grave that Western media started to pick it up. And what did they do? They started repeating whatever Israel said. As the story came out that Israel was clearly lying, which has happened repeatedly, they were forced to say, well, this casts doubt. This is the framing. This casts doubt on Israel's story. No, Israel lied. Because Israel lies repeatedly, but you'll never see that phrase used. You'll never, not only will you never see the phrase Israel lied used, but they will continue to cite Israeli sources as being factually true, despite the many, many lies that they have been caught in. So this is the sort of picture that has been created where whatever Israel says is fact, Palestinians who are actually the ones being slaughtered and are reporting their own news have to be verified somehow by some outside source in order for it to have legitimacy. And we can discuss, I mean, this is a separate conversation, I think. We can discuss the racial bias, the racism, the anti-Palestinian bias that plays into, the anti-Muslim bias, all of these layers that play into how the story is being told. But the reality of it is the story is not being told, at least not by the mainstream Western press.
Ezgi Basaran is an Oxford University scholar on the politics of the Middle East and Turkey, focusing on authoritarianism, Islamism, and the Kurdish question. Asal Rad is a scholar of Middle East history and a non-resident fellow at Dawn. Dawn was founded by Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, brutally murdered in 2018 on orders by Saudi chief and U.S. ally Mohammed bin Salman. Let's step back in. Moderator Mehmet Karli introducing British journalist Lauren Booth.
Now I will move on to Lauren. Lauren Booth. I mean, Lauren is a journalist, but not only a journalist, she is an activist as well, and a very active activist in that. She has been involved in, you know, just various aid campaigns towards Gaza. She has spent quite some time in Gaza, and she has been reporting, of course, on the Gazan genocide, you know, prolifically as well. Lauren, I know that you also, you know, have a few words to say regarding the Western media's framing and how this amounts to complicity. Do you want to speak from here or there? It's up to you.
Assalamu alaikum. Peace to you. What horrible testimony we've heard so far, but here's one to add to it that's very interesting. Julia Straker at the Nuremberg trials was convicted. He was convicted not of violence, not of partaking in violence, not of carrying a gun. He was convicted because his speeches and his writings were found to have contributed to genocide. He was hanged. When we talk about the complicity of journalism, we are not talking about a small thing now. We are talking about the arguments that have directly led and allowed the governments to make their arguments towards a genocide supporting Israel in what they do. And these arguments made in the press, by the way, allow a cover for the arms trade to continue, because Israel has a right to defend itself. So I do want to go a little bit in the next couple of minutes into frame building so that we all understand what it's about. And as my Turkish colleague here said, there's no accidents in journalism. Everything is sub-edited and checked. Nobody's just stumbling across these phrases. So linguistically, the term frame building refers to how journalists select stories, facts, and what to focus on at each point. And every story has a frame. When I first reported from the West Bank, I went to Jenin and I met children on the rubble of their homes. And I had to dig my nails into my hand almost until they bled to stop from crying and patronizing them with my Western tears. And I managed to do it. But I got a question out at the same time through a translator. What do you want to be, darling, when you grow up? I'm not saying I was a brilliant Middle Eastern journalist at that point. So I asked them, what do you want to be? And a 9-year-old said to me, I want to be a doctor. And the next little girl said, I want to be a teacher. And the next little girl said, I want to be a psychotherapist. These are on the rubble of their Jenin homes with no shoes. So I said, psychotherapist? Thinking, how does she even know that word? Why? And her answer went right to my heart. She said, because my people are in pain and I want to help them. I wrote this. Now, I was naive. It was my first article from Palestine. And I said to my editor, Peter Wright, at the Mail on Sunday, Peter, don't change a word or I'm pulling this article. You're not really allowed to say that as a journalist, by the way. I don't know who I thought I was, but I said, I'd rather you sack me and I don't do anything. I feel that strongly about what I've seen. He looked at it and he got back and he said, it's a great article. We'll print it. And I said, as is? He said, yes. And I had a moment of feeling that I'd brought world peace. It wasn't that hard to get stuff in about Palestine. What was everybody making a fuss about? I called all my Palestinian friends. I called Afif Safia, who was a delegate to the United Kingdom from Palestine at the time. I said, I've nailed it. Get the mail on Sunday next week. And there was the picture on the front page of the magazine of me standing in front of these beautiful Palestinian children on the rubble of their homes. And the headline across their faces said, which of these children will be a doctor and which a terrorist? This is part of making the argument for the crimes of today. It didn't start on October the 7th. It's not new, and it is deliberate. Now, the themes and sound bites that we've been seeing throughout this have been handpicked and chosen. Some of them are presented by think tanks, usually run by Zionist money from the United States, but Britain is perfectly capable of having our pro-Zionist think tanks too. And so if I say to you, bring them home, you can go, rescue the hostages. It's like a game. Beheaded babies, women were raped. Human shields, Hamas using the population. End Hamas. Here comes the mission creep of the Israelis. Shifa Command Center, it's under the ground. The tunnel's under the ground. But as my Turkish colleague said, you didn't see, you couldn't say anything from the Palestinian side. Do you have a soundbite that sticks in your mind from a representative from anywhere in Gaza that is memorable, that stays with you? This is not a game. This is very, very serious. And it is time that people are held accountable. And we have to think of the mechanisms that are going to allow that to happen. But first of all, we have to unpick. Who are these editors? Who are they working with? What is the phone call that comes in at 2 a.m, right? I've been in newsrooms like you. You know, the next day, had a phone call from the Israeli embassy. So what? I mean, literally, so what? Are we a British newspaper or not? But the right phone call at the right time, headlines get changed. We can't really have that person on. And I'll end with this, because it was one of the most visceral, kind of obvious moments on British TV. Hossam Zumlot, the Palestinian ambassador to the UK, in November 2023, had a great deal of members of his family wiped out in a Zionist missile, and he went straight into an interview on Newsnight with Kirsty Walk. And he said, look, my family in Khan Yunis have just been decimated, so, you know, this is what the weaponry is doing right now. And she said, oh, it's terrible to hear about that, but do you condone violence? This is a sickness, it is deliberate, and I would like to see us at this tribunal start looking at making the mechanisms that allow this to happen payable, pay a price, make journalists, welcome journalists who are whistleblowers, because there have been open letters from as early as the end of October 2023, trying to push for a fair hearing for the Palestinians. And finally, I'd like to say, just a big tribute to all of our colleagues who are on the ground in Gaza. I cut my teeth. Many of them taught me how to do a news package. And it's not just them that are targeted. I think we have to remember that when they go on a story, they know that at home they may not go back to their children and family. These are crimes, and I pray to God that they get paid for, and the Shaheed in heaven, and those who are doing this are going to hell. Thank you.
Lauren Booth is a British broadcaster and journalist. She was speaking at a roundtable on journalism at the Gaza Tribunal late last May in Sarajevo. We'll link to the Gaza Tribunal's website at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
Get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
This is Bird Note. From a wooded thicket along the lower Rio Grande River comes a rich, whistled song. Your eye catches a flash of brilliant orange. There's the singer, an Altamira oriole, a dashing bird. Its orange body contrasts beautifully with its black breastplate and eye patch. One of the largest orioles, at 10 inches from beak to tail, the Altamira is a tropical resident year-round, reaching into the United States only in southernmost Texas. And it was only in 1939 that the Altamira oriole was first found north of the Rio Grande. Now, it happily visits residents on the Texas side of the river, especially where juicy orange slices wait in a backyard feeder. Northerly breeding orioles, like the Bullocks in the west and the Baltimore in the east, are migratory. These orange beauties nest as far north as Canada, but winter mostly in Central America. Their songs, too, are memorable, but no match for the music of the Altamira oriole. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Bird Note gives you the sounds of birds every day, and you get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram at Bird Note Radio.